Vayihyu chayei sarah mea shana v'yasrim shana v'sheva shanim shnei chayei sarah.
Back of throws. There's a long pass. It's going to be, I believe. The Giants win the pellet. 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 Bobby Thompson hits into the very back of the left field stand. The Giants win the pellet. And they're going crazy. They're going crazy.
OU Israel presents...
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Chayei Sarah. Recording and first broadcast, Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the 20th of Mar Cheshvan, 5771, October 28th, 2010. Most significantly, in the non-religious sense, is the fact that it is after the first game of the World Series, which the Giants won against the Texas Rangers with a score of 11-7. Not exactly the pitcher's duel that was predicted, but a sweet victory nonetheless to savor, as I hope all Giant fans are doing. The clip that you heard at the opener after the first verse of Chayei Sarah, it was followed, I guess I have to say, Lahavdil, by the famous call of the shot heard round the world, the home run by Bobby Thompson in the 1951 playoff games, where the Dodgers and Giants had finished the season in a tie, and the tiebreaker was best 2 out of 3 games, and the Giants came from behind with a stunning home run in the bottom of the 9th inning to win the game. That sentiment of the Giants win the pennant was echoed this year, not too long ago, when the Giants beat the Phillies in the National League Championship playoffs, but you know that, I am sure. But I like saying it because this could turn out to be one of the only Torah-oriented shows that also throws in sports. I had opportunity earlier this week to appear briefly on Nachum Siegel's JM in the AM, which was broadcast actually from the Israel Center building, a short way from my studio, aka my office. And there the two of us sparred about my being a Giants fan and he being a Yankees fan, and we had a good time. But the bottom line is, the headline of this week's lead tidbit in Torah Tidbits is the Giants win the pennant, and I proceeded to explain certain things of lessons to be learned from baseball on Jewish Hashkafa. I don't know if I'm going to repeat any of those now, but for now, let's leave it, and let us say Tehillim Kuf Lamed, although in celebration of a victory of the first game of the World Series, we should really switch to the alternative chapter that we read on days we don't say Tachanun, but I'll be more conventional. Psalm 130, Tehillim Kuf Lamed. Shir ha-ma'alot mi-ma'amakim k'raticha Adonai. Adonai shima v'koli, tihyena aznecha kashuvot l'kol tachanunai. Im avonot tishmoria Adonai mi-ya'amod, ki imacha ha-salicha l'ma'an tivarei. Ki viti Adonai kivata nafshi v'lidvaro ho-cholti.
Nafshi l'Adonai mi shomerim l'aboker, shomerim l'aboker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai ki im Adonai ha-chesed v'harbe imo fedut. V'hu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanatunim batzara uvashivya, ha-omedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, ha-makom yirachem aleihem, v'yotzieim mitzara lirvacha u'me'afela l'ora, u'mishibud l'gu'ula, hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv, v'nomar amen. A very short while ago, I recorded a mini shiur to the Torah Tidbits folders on a topic related to this week's Torah reading. I would like to share that with the listeners of Torah Tidbits audio, and then we will talk more about Parshat Chayei Sarah. With your permission, I would like to talk about the issue that comes up in Parshat Chayei Sarah about Eliezer. By the way, Eliezer's name does not appear at all in the Sedra, which is quite remarkable. He is referred to as Eved Avraham, the servant of Avraham, Ha-Eved, the servant, Ha-Ish, the man, but never by name. And that's something by itself. His name is not important, even though we happen to know it. It's his function as Eved Avraham, and his being accepted by the other side as the man. In other words, he looked at himself as a servant. Avraham looked at him as a servant, but Rivka's family treated him with much more courtesy, we'll say, than a servant would ordinarily get. But that's not the point. The point is, Eliezer asks God for a sign. He says, please God, help me out, because I don't know what I'm doing here. The girl that will come and offer me to drink and also give water to my camels, that will be the sign that that's the shidduch for Yitzchak. The Torah tells us that before he finished even saying these words to God, Rivka comes out. He sees her. Midrashim say he saw certain things that impressed him. And he asks her for water. She offers him water and to draw water for the camels. And he thanks God for that. The Gemara says that there were a couple of different people in Tanakh who asked things of God inappropriately and were answered successfully anyway. Example, Eliezer. Gemara says Eliezer was not beseder. He did not behave properly by asking God for a sign. God answered him anyway. On the humorous side, years and years ago, a couple of friends of mine and I put together a skit of different outcomes of the Eliezer at the well scenario, which were not like the one the Torah tells us, exactly because Eliezer did not ask appropriately. In other words, anybody could have come out, and he wouldn't know necessarily whether it was the proper person. Commentaries point to the fact that he gave her gifts even before asking who she was, before finding out that she was part of Avraham's family, and they say that's part of why the Gemara says that he behaved inappropriately. But God favored him with a proper response anyway. Rambam goes further. Rambam says what Eliezer did was forbidden. You cannot rely on signs. The commentaries on Rambam jump on him and say, this is not that kind of sign that you're not allowed to rely on. If a person says, should I buy the piece of property that someone offered me yesterday or not? I know, I'll walk out of my house this morning, And if the first person I run into is a male, I'll buy it. If it's a female, I won't. Or if a black cat crosses someone's path, and based on that, he reads it as a bad omen and makes a decision in his course of the day based on that, that's forbidden. That's a very serious avera, in not exactly, but in the same ballpark as idolatry. It is betraying God, because God says to the Jewish people, be straightforward and simple with your relationship with me. Tamim tihyeh im Hashem Elokecha. Those who defend Eliezer's sign point to the fact that a girl offering a stranger water to drink and offering to water 10 camels who must drink a tremendous amount of water is a sign of a good person. And therefore, rather than it being a sign, it was a personality indicator, and that's good. That issue as to whether Eliezer was appropriate or not, or whether it was forbidden for him to do what he did or not, is left as a discussion among commentaries, some saying he did the right thing, some say he did the wrong thing. The bottom line for us is we have to tread very carefully when we enter this whole idea of signs. And signs go along with superstitions and a whole bunch of other things as well. I know from personal experience, and I'm sure everyone here does, we grew up with things that were done which seemed to be superstitious, and we were told, no, this is a well-time-honored thing. And then other things that we said, okay, is this okay? No, goyish a superstition. You know, where do you draw the line? When you spill salt, do you throw salt over your shoulder? Do you avoid stepping on cracks on the sidewalk? You know, there are people who avoid stepping on cracks on the sidewalk because they don't want to trip. I think that's very good. But a person who avoids a crack on a sidewalk because he doesn't want a broken back, you know, there's a little problem with that. What about walking over somebody's feet when he's sitting on the floor? You know, sitting up against the wall with his feet stretched out? How many are aware of the fact that people say you're not supposed to walk over his feet? And they even make you walk back over his feet if you walked over the first time, because you'll stunt his growth. Now, if they say, don't walk over somebody's feet, you might trip and get hurt and hurt that person, makes sense. A broken mirror, which has shards of glass, is a danger. But it does not portend 7 years of bad luck, and walking under a ladder is usually a stupid thing to do, because the ladder could fall, or the person could fall, or the bucket of paint can fall, but it should not be seen as a bad sign. You don't want to open up an umbrella inside because you don't want to poke someone's eye out with the top of the umbrella. That's good. If you don't do it because it's a sign of bad luck, that's not Jewish. Yet in Judaism, which I don't have answers for, we have a zillion canina horror things. Evil eye and red string that was wrapped around Kever Rachel on people's wrists, and poo-poo-poo and a red bendel. I have a cousin who dressed her kids to I don't know how age. Every single one always had something red. I know that when I moved into my first apartment in the States, I brought with me a candle, salt, sugar, and I forgot what else.
Red.
Okay, but that's not a superstition kind of thing. That maybe is a symbolic gesture. And making a move on Tuesday rather than another day of the week because of Pamayim Kitov. So we've got our share of these things, and we have warnings. Let me crystallize this in the form of astrology. Picture the following scenario. You're sitting in the waiting office of a doctor, a dentist, a barber, I don't care where, and there's a newspaper on the table. And the newspaper happens to be turned to the page that has the horoscopes. So you say, look, I'm waiting here anyway. I didn't bring a book of my own to learn from and or to read. You pick up the paper idly, and you notice your sign, and it says something very vague about today is a good day to have a business dealing with a friend. And later that afternoon, something comes up, and it's a business deal with a friend. And you remember that you had read this thing, which you, at the time that you read it, considered it to be nonsense. But you say, hey, wait a minute, you know, hey. And the next day, you go to the newsstand. You're not ready to buy the paper, but you do happen to casually open to the open to the astrology page, to the zodiac Mazalot, and you notice what happens. This could lead to a person actually not making a significant move without consulting astrology. Now, anyone who knows astrology knows that what they write in the newspapers under a person's sign has no significance even in the world of astrology, because astrologers take it much more detailed and seriously. Not you were born under Virgo, but you were born under Virgo when Mars was in the third house and the moon was here, and now you have to burst out in song about the age of Aquarius and all of that kind of stuff. So whether it's a serious astrology reading or not, there's a red flag warning here. Let's put it like this. It is absolutely forbidden for a Jew to determine a course of action based on an astrological reading. And therefore, anything that might lead to that, including the casual happen to notice in the paper, or the talking about it, or whatever, is a warning sign. However, the reason why astrology is forbidden for us to determine our activities, I keep saying that, and I want to qualify that in a moment, but the reason that that level is forbidden is because God's relationship that he wants with the Jewish people is a more direct relationship. There's an episode based in last week's Sedra of Vayera with Avraham Avinu, where God takes him outdoors and says, look up into the sky, you will have descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky. Avraham objected, and according to the Medrash, he said, thanks for the kind words. I'm making this up on my own. But the Medrash says that Avraham said, I, as an astrologer, which he was, saw in the stars that I am fated not to have children. So how can you say to me that my descendants will be as numerous as the stars of the heavens? The answer to that from the Medrash is that there is such a thing as mazal, based on the stars, but a Jew has the power to rise above his fated mazal, provided he follows the mitzvot, follows the Torah, keeps the mitzvot, etc. And that's what God was saying to Avraham. Yes, I know that you saw that you were fated not to have children, but that's not ironclad. That can change, and it will change. So now we have one point of view about astrology, that it actually is something, although we're not allowed to play with it. The other view, Rambam again, is that the reason we're not allowed to do this is because it's utter nonsense. And therefore it's a total waste of time, and you're putting your beliefs in something that's totally false. Others say, no, there is something real about it, we are just forbidden to dabble in it. Now, there's one aspect of astrology that we are not forbidden to learn about, and that is what astrologers consider to be the tendencies of people born under a certain mazal. For example, they could say about a certain person, based on when you were born, your native born tendencies lean towards blood, towards bloodshed and blood. That does not mean that the person is going to be a mass murderer. It does mean or indicate, if you want to follow it, that maybe he should choose a profession or an occupation that does not fight that natural tendency, but channels it in a good way, like being a shochet, or being a mohel, or, pardon?
Or a physician.
Or a physician, a surgeon, or whatever. So we don't believe that a person at birth is locked in to whether he will be good or bad, because that takes away the whole concept of free will and the choices that a person has in life. But we do, at least according to one point of view, recognize that we have leanings. Some people lean towards very laid back, non-excitable. Others lean towards a trigger temper. Others are somewhere in between. A trigger temper is usually bad, but there are still ways of channeling that kind of energy if you are aware of yourself. I am aware, I'm using this as an example, the fact that it happens to be true or not is irrelevant. Let's say I am aware that I have a nature that is very stubborn. Don't like to admit that I make mistakes or I did something wrong. I am naturally stubborn. This is confirmed by the fact that I was born in Iyar, which is Taurus, the bull. And one of the properties that's attributed with it is stubbornness. Now, whether you believe that or not, there's a school of thought that says you don't fight it. Let's say you have, because of when you were born or because of your upbringing or because you breastfed or you didn't breastfeed or you had prunes when you were a little kid and you didn't like them. It doesn't matter. Let's say you recognize in yourself certain properties, certain qualities, and one of them is stubbornness. There is a channel, a way of channeling it for the good, and that's the challenge.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. You are listening to Torah Tidbits audio for Parshat Chayei Sarah, and we were towards the end, or let's say well past the midpoint, of that mini shiur to the folders about Eliezer and astrology and wherever else we branched off. Let's continue that now, and then we'll talk more about Chayei Sarah.
It's not usually possible to take a native-born or nurtured-in-childhood personality trait and say, hocus-pocus, I'm going to change it. But you certainly have the ability to channel it in a proper direction. And sometimes you could do it on your own, and sometimes you get advice on how to do it. And, using the example of a shochet, my mother, Olea Shalom, always told us that her father, my Zaidi, was offered a position in his town to study Shechita and become the town shochet, because they liked him and they trusted him and he was an honest person. So he went to the first class or the first demonstration, and he went back to the people who wanted to sponsor him and said, "Not for me." And there are some people who cannot. The Mishnah says the best of the butchers is a partner of Amalek, meaning that you need a cruel streak in you to be a butcher. That is not necessarily a criticism of a person unless he lets it come out in the wrong way. But if he got involved in being a butcher or in being a pathologist where he's cutting up dead bodies for the good of society and fighting disease and finding cause of death and catching murderers and things like that, he took a natural tendency, which not everybody has, and channeled it in a proper direction. So there is an aspect of astrology that's acceptable, but there's a line that cannot be crossed. And that is, don't do that because you are an Aries, and an Aries shouldn't do that. That's not good. That's not kosher, whether it's true or not. That's not the way we are to behave in our relationship with God. And it applies to astrology, and it applies to conjuring, and it implies to seances. I mean, seances, whether you can't channel that well. A seance, attempt to conquer, communicate with the dead, is absolutely forbidden on Jewish law. In fact, when one visits the cemetery, you really should be guided, and I don't have all of the details, but you have to know what you're allowed to do and say and what you're not allowed to do. You can't say, "Dad, I know you've been gone for 12 years and I really miss you." That's fine. But then to say, "How about putting in a good word with God, you know, that I should, whatever." That's a big problem. A big, big problem, because you don't communicate with the dead. The dead belong to a world, you belong to a different world, and that world has a transition that goes temporarily in one direction only. Tchiyat HaMetim is another story, then there's a two-way street, but you got to be very careful. When you go to Kever Rachel, you are not to pray to Rachel Imenu. You pray to God. You're praying in the presence of Kever Rachel, which maybe is Kever Rachel and maybe is not, but that's another story. And you're charged with inspiration and emotion because of where you are, but you're talking to God. You don't ask the Kotel for things, you ask God for things. If going to the Kotel inspires you, and you write a kfittel and you stick it between the cracks of the stones, you are writing a note to God. You are not writing to the Kotel or to the Beit HaMikdash or Har HaBayit or any of that stuff. Let's take two practices which we have around Yamim Noraim. One is Tashlich and one is Kaparot, Kaparos. Each one has a kosher, acceptable way to do it, and a way that's extremely problematic. If a person goes to a riverside or to a body of water and thinks that he is literally casting his sins into the water and walking away from there sin-free, A, he's greatly mistaken, and B, if he's counting on it, it smacks of borderline idolatry. Kaparot. There were rabbonim in Europe who banned schlugging kaparos because people spent obscene amounts of money to buy a pure white rooster or hen for kaparos. They would inspect the feathers. If the feathers had any brown on them, they would go for another one, and when they found a pure white bird, they would feel as if they had a vehicle of ridding themselves of sin, to the point where the Rabbonim in Europe said, "This is Darkei Emori, it's an idolatrous practice, and we hereby forbid it." What do you mean? How could I do Yom Kippur without kaparos? I'll tell you how. You fast, you daven, you do tshuva, you cry a little, you talk to God. That'll work. You don't need the chicken. So why do we have the chicken? Or why do we have money to tzedakah instead of the chicken? It's a symbol. The chicken was meant to impress upon the person the frailty of life. Here is a living and breathing being held in your hands. You feel it breathing. You feel its heart beating. And in a short while, it goes under the knife of the shochet. The chicken will be prepared to feed poor people as an act of charity and tzedakah. That's wonderful. But that reminder of the frailty of life is what kaparot was meant to be. It was not meant to be construed as a hocus-pocus, and if it is, it's a serious, serious problem. I can't fault, as you, your example, saying to the departed that the Braves lost in the finals to the Giants, in the semifinals, whatever. You could admit that and, whatever. But depends how serious you take it. Because on the one hand, you believe the person knows better than you do, what happened in the game, if they care, And it's certainly not their body in the grave that still cares about it, and their neshama does not hang around there, which is part of the problem. The neshama is not, some say that the neshama hangs around during Shiva, and some say even during Shloshim, and maybe the whole year. But at a certain point, the neshama goes where it came from and is not there. A memory is there. And memories sometimes manifest themselves by saying certain things, and even lamenting. Oh, if you were only here, so-and-so would maybe not have turned out the way he did, or whatever. And, that's one thing. I don't think that's bad. But saying, can you see to it that so-and-so gets a shidduch, is a problem. That's Dorei Shal HaMeitim. I'm going to try to get more definitive guidelines if they exist, and I'll share them with you. But that's where it started with Eliezer, and turned out okay. Rivka Imenu was a good person. And as I said, the Gemara's bottom line, Eliezer did not act beseder, but he got it anyway. It's almost like all of those jokes they have about the person finding a bottle with a genie, and the genie offers one wish, three wishes, and the guy makes a wish, meaning one thing, but ending up with something else. That was the shiur to the Torah Tidbits folders. We'll have more Parshat Chayisara after a musical interlude. I do not have the disc information in front of me, just the name Schoenfeld.
יחד כולם אוי דובי המליחו ויומו אוי דובי המליחו ויומו יחד כולם אוי דובי המליחו ויומו אוי דובי המליחו ויומו יחד כולם אוי דובי המליחו ויומו אוי דובי המליחו ויומו
long time ago, I heard in a shiur by Rabbi Shalom Gold an interesting idea about where Rivka Imenu developed the personality that allowed her to be Rivka Imenu. Eliezer, the servant of Avraham, is sent back to his hometown to find a suitable bride for Yitzchak. Rivka displayed such qualities of kindness and helpfulness, and these symbolized a whole slew of favorable characteristics worthy of being one of the matriarchs of the Jewish people. Where'd she get it from? From her brother Lavan in Betuel's house in Aram Naharaim? So Rabbi Gold suggested, I don't know exactly on what he based this, but he suggested that Devora Meneches Rivka, Devora, whose name we find out later when she dies and she is mourned and cried over by Yaakov and family, Devora was the nursemaid that Lavan and Betuel wasn't alive anymore, Lavan's mother and Lavan sent Rivka with Eliezer back to Avraham and Yitzchak, accompanied by her meineket, her nurse, who we find out later, as I just mentioned, was Devora. Where did she come from? The suggestion is that when Avraham and Sarah were influencing many, many people in belief in God, they took most of these new believers with them when they went to the land of Canaan, but Devora, Meineket Rivka, was purposely left back in order to supervise the early stage of Rivka's development. And we have to credit her, without really knowing too much about her, with the shaping of the personality of Rivka Imenu that made her the proper successor to Sarah Imenu, as Yitzchak himself was the heir apparent and successor to Avraham Avinu. This now leads in to a general kind of observation. Whatever Avraham Avinu was, whatever he and Sarah accomplished, would have died with them without Yitzchak. And unless Yitzchak was a high caliber person, which he was, it would have died there also. What I'm trying to say is that second generation is a crucial link in a chain of tradition that, as it's as if to say, no question about Avraham's role, about Avraham's determination, about his personality and what he discovered and what he preached, but it would go nowhere unless he had a special son, and unless that son, Yitzchak Avinu, would be worthy of receiving the heritage of Avraham, preserving it, nurturing it, and passing it on to the next generation. Didn't have to worry about Avraham, so to speak, but it was Yitzchak that was a prime concern. And when you see the sequence in Parshat Lech Lecha going into Vayera and touched upon here in Chayei Sarah as well, you have first Avraham said, I don't think I'm going to have any children. I don't think I'm destined to have any children. Eliezer, my faithful servant, will carry on after me. God said, nothing doing. You're going to have your own child. And Yishmael was born, and Avraham thought that that was the child to carry on his heritage, and God said, no, you got that wrong too. Ki v'Yitzchak yikarei l'chazara. It's through Yitzchak that things will be passed down from you to the next generation and from a worthy successor to the following generations. That second generation was crucial. The Haftorah reflects the same idea. David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayam, whatever King David was, he was. And yet, it would go nowhere unless he had the proper, worthy successor. And that's what the Haftorah tells us about, Shlomo HaMelech. The second link in a chain of tradition is not the first, but is not like any other either, because only in its strength can that second link put together the previous generation, not just with the third generation, but with all generations to come. That's a role fit for Yitzhak Avinu. Just reflecting on something I said earlier in that shear to the folders, the name Eliezer is conspicuously absent in the book of the Sedra of Chaye Sarah, where he is really the main personality. But what's interesting is to track the number of times he's called Eved or Ha-Eved, servant, the servant of Abraham. How often he's called Ish, the person, and who calls him that. And to me, one of the most telling verses that there is something to what I'm suggesting, that the name is less important than the roles that he plays. Watch this. The verse follows when Rivka was consulted and made the decision to go with Eliezer back to Avraham and Yitzchak. Vatokam Rivka v'na'aroteha. Rivka arose together with her entourage. Vatirkavna al hagmalim. They rode on the camels. Vatelachna, and they went acharei ha'ish, after the man, Eliezer. Vayikach ha'eved et Rivka vayelach. And the servant, Eliezer, took Rivka and went. Same verse, but you see the transition. Once she accepts to become part of the family of Avraham and Yitzchak, to accept the proposal of marriage and the betrothal to Yitzchak, then by following the Ish, the person that she had perceived as the man, he now becomes the Eved to Rivka as well. So his name, less important, his position and function as a representative of Avraham Avinu and of Yitzchak, all important. One more small point. Avraham made Eliezer swear that he would fulfill his mission to bring back a suitable bride for Yitzchak, but Yitzchak was not asked to swear anything in that respect. From here, our sages teach us that a child is allowed to refuse and cannot be forced by the requirement of honoring and revering his parents to marry someone he doesn't choose to marry. He made a free will choice for Rivka. Eliezer, as the servant, he was the one who had to take an oath, not Yitzchak. On that note, let me wish you a Shabbat Shalom, Lehishtameah.